winter in the middle of July. He said, girl, you better pray for the heavenly gift of self-control. I said, Daddy, God's gift that I devour it all. Got to show the right type of reverence. So I take the whole, not half but all. Can't live on hope in short supply. Faith then you're only just getting by, by, by. It's not due. It feels like winter in the middle of July. Got some old dead friends, knowing no amount of time could ever make amends. And then never knowing, and then never really showing it all.
Hello, Radio World. This is Hazy. You are listening to CITR 101.9 FM. Broadcasting Vancouver's haziest since 1950.
Who's the fool with the hard look? Shmodio! Shmodio!
Hello, my arms are in the air for some reason right now. Hello, they're in the air because I'm so excited. Welcome to Shmodio. You're listening to CITR Radio 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live on the unceded and stolen Musqueam territory. My name is Ruby Raven. Welcome to Shmodio. And maybe put your hands in the air, just like me, especially if you're driving, because it's super safe. We're back with more TIFF coverage. Me and Callum, a producer on Shmodio, we were lucky enough to be able to go to TIFF a couple weeks ago and watch a ton of incredible films and talk to a ton of very interesting, creative, passionate people. And last episode was our first TIFF coverage episode. Today is our second. And I'm really excited because this is the first time that we're ever hearing from Callum as an interviewer. This is his first interview with Shmodio, and he does an amazing job, as I expected, because he's a great conversationalist and very interested in people. His first interview today that we're going to hear is an interview with the writers and directors of Uproar. Uproar was a film that he was really excited to see, because he sort of knew of these creators before. And I'll just read a little bit of the description of Uproar. Julian Dennison delivers another charismatic performance in a witty and wise story about a young student trying to find his place among New Zealand's fight for its national identity in the 80s. So it's obviously has this like serious political backdrop, but it's also very funny. And the lead actor is very charming and hilarious. And that's really what drew Callum, I think, if I remember correctly. We're going to hear from him. Then we're going to hear an interview that I did on the red carpet with Sam Levy. So this is really funny because I did a lot of red carpet interviews when I was at TIFF talking to the people that were on the red carpet. And before I play that interview, I'll explain a little bit of like the logistics of how this TIFF went because of the writers and the actors strike that was going on simultaneously. But I'll explain that before I play the interview. But it's a little weird because it's not sort of like a standard interview. It's a red carpet. There's like background noise. There's lots of people talking. So it's a different type of interview for Shmodio. But I'm going to be playing a lot of those because that's what we did at TIFF. We did a lot of these sort of quick on-the-fly interviews that were really, really interesting. Okay, so now that we know what's going to happen today on this episode, let's hear Callum Rudick, Shmodio producer. Let's hear his interview with Paul Middleditch and Hamish Bennett. Here we go.
Hi, folks. Callum from the future here, just to give a quick disclaimer, letting you know that there are a few pops and cracks throughout this recording. I've removed them whenever possible, and unfortunately had to leave them in a few times due to the live recording environment. Not very easy to edit around, but I hope that you can bear through them to listen to this interview that I had with Paul Middleditch and Hamish Bennett, the directors and writers behind the new film Uproar, which I had the pleasure of seeing in advance at this year's TIFF. Decided to still broadcast this interview despite the auditory malfunctions, as I think it's very informative and pleasant. So I hope that you can enjoy it. Now, without further ado, here is my interview with Paul Middleditch and Hamish Bennett.
This is Callum Rudick for CITR and Discorder Magazine, here with Paul Middleditch and Hamish Bennett, speaking about their new film, Uproar. And as we do for all our interviews before we start, I would like to acknowledge that TIFF and all of our associated coverage takes place on the treaty lands and territory of the Mississaugas of the Credit, and the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, the Wendat, and the Haudenosaunee. As I said, we do this for all of our interviews, but especially for this film, I felt it was important as this is covering Indigenous struggles, not only in New Zealand, but also, you know, largely in its themes, very relevant to Canada and to all of North America. So I'd like to thank you two for being here and for creating such a fantastic representation of New Zealand's culture. I felt it was very impactful and it reminded me a lot of some of my experiences here in Canada. So I thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry, I know you're interviewing us, Callum, but can you tell us a bit about your experiences? You know, did you see some parallels for yourself?
I absolutely did. I thank you for reversing it. So it's very interesting. But I went to school in Victoria in British Columbia, and we have the luck of having a very strong relationship with local Indigenous bands. So we had elders coming into the school very often to speak to us. We had a lot of consultation with the school. And all around, you know, there's lots of talk about history, but also the present experience of Indigenous struggles. And I felt that in the film, there was a really strong relationship between the present and the past, because, of course, the film takes place in 1984. But the themes and the way you approach it, I felt it was very intentional to bring things up that were relevant to today, to now.
Yeah, I think that's spot on, Callum. And I think you're right. I think the history of our country, and I'm sure it's similar to a lot of other Indigenous cultures, it directly relates to the issues faced by our people, in contemporary times, mm-hmm. And certainly in 1981, it was a relatively it was a period of great upheaval for our country.
Yes.
Because you know, at the time. I think the overall feeling across New Zealand was that we had our race relations were pretty good, and I think what was created with the tour of New Zealand by the South African rugby team was this, I guess, a cruel irony for many Māori, in that many Māori saw a lot of New Zealanders protesting what was going on in South Africa and the issues that were quite rightly being protested for Indigenous people in Africa, without necessarily being aware of the issues being faced by Māori within our own country.
And it's a sad thing, of course, because you hear this phrase repeated in the film very often, that is repeated all around us, which is the, you know, just get over it. Why can't you let us enjoy our rugby game? Why can't you know, keep it on this side and, you know, behind this barrier? And that's been going for decades. So what I was wondering was, how long has this sort of idea for the film been in the back of your minds? And was it, especially before the massive rise in Black Lives Matter protests in 2020, I felt especially with the themes of, you know, the character of Josh recording these protests and how that sort of spreads information and also inspires him to, you know, reclaim his identity, and how that sort of parallels the way that the proliferation of videos of protests really ignited this fire in people. And it feels in some ways that the film is making a comment about how things, you know, change, but they've also stayed the same for so long.
Yeah.
So if you could speak more about that.
So the film, the inspiration for the film came from my childhood. Started the process over 10 years ago.
Wow.
And it was based on my experiences at a high school in Wellington in New Zealand during the Springbok tour. And I was, Josh was based on, I suppose, my experiences at school as a misfit, as feeling I didn't fit into, let's say, the rugby culture of the school, the colonial culture of the school. The fact is that I was, I had a different, more artistic side to myself, which led to a lot of bullying and all of those kind of things. So originally the script was always set in 1981 in the Springbok tour, because I felt at that time it was probably the most interesting political moment in our country's history, based around an obsessive game that we love. And so you had politics versus sport, and there was so much to be got from that, and parallels between the struggle of what was happening with Josh. Then, as I was developing the script and so on with Sonia Whiteman, Julian came on board and was really excited to play one of the other characters in the picture, but then he said to me, I'd love to play Josh. And that just suddenly was very exciting and scary, because it suddenly meant that as a part Māori actor, he was going to take on all of these issues and lift and elevate the idea in regards to Indigenous things and racism and so on in the country. And at that point, we went, and that's when Hamish came on board as well, then started to take on and wrote Josh beautifully from his perspective as well, and then really brought in themes into the film that were so beautiful in heightening it and lifting it and making it higher as an idea, which had very much to do with his identity, with what was the struggle within his own background in terms of New Zealand, coming from the South Island, the bottom of the South Island, Ngāi Tahu. And then he went, wow, there's a story to be told there, and you can probably go from there.
Yeah. As Paul said, I came on board 2 or 3 years ago. First order to look at the script, given that Julian had stepped into the lead role. And I was aware that it was a very personal story for Paul. And so it was, for me, first of all, was looking at the script as a writer, but potentially as a co-director. At that time, I was happy to look at the script from a writing point of view, but I wasn't necessarily sure about co-directing. I didn't know Paul at the time, and I felt that could present its challenges. But I think the more I worked on the script, and the more I found my connection, and found my I felt my investment in these characters and in this journey, the more reluctant I was to let go of that, and so it was a lot of work on getting that story into a position where I felt that it could be something that I'd really love to be involved with, but at the same time paying respect to the lovely foundation that Sonia had built for us with the script, but also paying respect to the fact that this was a very personal story for Paul too. So I was trying to take on, there's layers of complexity that needed to be addressed, I guess. And that took time, but I feel that we eventually came to a point where we were able to do that in a way that told a story that ultimately is a very hopeful story that is not heavy-handed and that is able to address relatively heavy themes with a light touch, which is something that is incredibly important to us. We first of all want the story to be enjoyed, not to be necessarily seen as a comment on society or anything
right.
like that.
Yeah, yes. He was very, very much about not wanting to. We didn't want to feel like there was any preaching going on in the film, and I thought that was really beautifully handled in terms of and our actors had an ability to be able to create that so that there was just truth. You know what I mean? You don't feel that there was. We weren't. And that's why I think the themes in the film are really powerful, because they're coming from a personal side and not necessarily just from a didactic side or something like that. It actually was coming from their own life experience, their own feelings of this situation, this sense of, and Tui has some beautiful parts in the film where she can just say the simplest thing, I didn't know that about your people. Oh, they're your people too.
I've noted that.
Things like that,
down,
which
yeah.
are... And that's one of the most beautiful, pivotal moments. And I know anybody who sees that, regardless of your cultural background, anybody goes, I feel that. You know that. Yes. You know. And so it's interesting, the film itself is about our people, New Zealand, but specifically, let's look at the culture, the Māori culture, and understand where that heart lies, that we can all get something from. Mm-hmm. You know, we can sit and watch what going is going through Josh's journey and Julian, who had a huge amount of investment in the picture. It was an enormously personal film for him, enormously so, because he related a lot to what Josh was and how he created so much beautiful depth in that. And a huge amount of that, of course, was Hamish seeing... finding his character, finding his performer, finding the way that he survived at school, all of that beautiful stuff, his humor, his comedy, his deflection, all of that, and then tie that up with Madigan beautifully, who from Hamish's point of view, knowing from a school teacher background and having been in the school and still being school teacher, it is so much believability in Madigan and their relationship, and it's just really delightful because when we did have Madigan in the screenplay, when Hamish came on board, but Madigan was really became the gorgeous complexity of what Rhys can bring, because I think of you just got to have been there to done it, you have to have fought in Afghanistan to know what it's like to be in Afghanistan, and so there's something awesome about that. Do you know what I mean? It felt so real. It was great.
I would like to point out that Madigan certainly isn't based on me as a teacher. But I think, as Paul was saying, I've been a teacher for over 20 years. I still teach part time. It's something that's very important to me, and I think probably one of the things that I will always connect to is the kids who may not necessarily feel like they fit in. And I think you have a tremendous power as a teacher to try to understand a child, and to try and find that connection to that child, because once you've got that, then you can make some movement with them.
Right.
And I feel that's something that can't be underestimated. You have a real privilege as a teacher to have that. And I think, I guess as much as Madigan is, it was totally wholly encompassed by Rhys, I think he is, for all his flaws as a teacher, very good-hearted. And I think a good heart goes a long way as a teacher.
Yes.
You may not be the greatest practitioner. He's certainly not the greatest acting coach, but he has a very good heart and he means well. And I think that matters a lot.
I think it is quite wonderful, the relationship between Julian and him, because Rhys and Julian work so well. But you just on repeat viewings, you just watch every time Madigan comes in. There's a sense of Julian kind of going, here we go again. It's like he's Adam, like when he comes out of the school. Hey, do you know about NIDA? And it's like it's just wonderful because you know that Rhys is going. Madigan is so living through Josh. He's so giving birth. He's on stage. And there's something really lovely about that, because particularly at the end, that journey is beautiful when he goes to Julian's mum and says, in a different way, it's like, you should see something I've seen that you don't know.
Yes.
And it's quite beautiful.
I wanted to ask, you spoke a bit about how Julian came into the production, but I wanted to hear a little more about how Rhys stepped into the role, because he takes on that role so fantastically, the way you described it.
Yeah, well, I think, Rhys is a wonderful comedic actor. After he read the script, I think the main connection that Rhys found was he had a teacher like that as a as a student himself. He had someone who saw his performative side and tried to embrace it and develop it and nurture it. I think also for us with Rhys, as much as he's known primarily as a comedic actor, and you still, Rhys is always going to bring Rhys to his performances. I think, he brought a depth which we were incredibly grateful for to his character and a willingness to go to, I guess, some pretty dramatically, I keep using the word heavy, places, but he was very comfortable going into those places with Josh, because I think Josh, he cared about him, and I think he was if you're gonna have a teacher who cares about someone, he needs to go to those places.
And he was, I think what was great too is I think that he saw an opportunity to do something that was different, a dramatic performance. He's a fine actor, and I think I think people will be really wonderfully surprised seeing that depth of what he does. And there's some really vulnerable and beautiful moments in this picture. I mean, the scene that he has where he's vulnerable in front of Josh in the classroom, if you remember that scene.
Yes.
You've never seen him do that, and I think it was really cathartic and quite moving. Yeah, I think the exciting thing in this picture, our whole cast had really something at stake in this movie. We had something at stake in this movie, and we were all vulnerable. And that was actually really what was quite exciting about it. Everybody had something You know what I mean? They were going to a place that they wanted to go to, but they needed to have the security and safety to feel the environment allowed that. Very much so.
Yes. I wanted to ask, and it's interesting you bring up how different people coming in would bring their own kind of stakes and investments. Mm. So you have Minnie Driver playing Josh's mother in the film, and Minnie Driver, a really fantastic dramatic actor with a long career behind her. And then Julian, who's sort of stepping in after becoming beloved as a child actor in films like Hunt for the Wilder People and Deadpool. Do you feel that their relationship sort of brought out this new side of Julian as a dramatic actor?
I think the environment itself, I think Julian always saw in this role, he could, no longer from the point of view of the second lead or the comic actor, this was a complete role for him to hold the film and actually drive the film. And I think when Minnie came into the process, she was really beneficial because she was a great disciplined actress, great actress too. And so I think that, yes, that certainly helped the environment, but I think Julian always had it in him. Mm-hmm. You know, it didn't feel to me like it was something, he had it in him well before we're doing it. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I do think, yeah, as much as absolutely having someone like Minnie Driver is always going to elevate your film.
Yeah.
But I think what Julian always carried is he was well aware of, I guess, the weight of responsibility that he carried as with his character. He understood. His mum's actually Tui in the film. Has his actual
mom. First time they've acted together. I didn't know that.
And so she has experience from that 1981 tour. She was involved in some of the protests, and so his understanding of that time is there. I also think that again speaking from my point of view as a Māori filmmaker, you know, we do carry this sense of responsibility that if we are going to be portraying these characters, then you portray them with as much truth and authenticity as you can, which is absolutely what he did.
There's, I think, a lot of, we spoke a bit about some of the difficulties and the pain going into the premise, but there's also so much joy that comes out of it. And a lot of the most touching moments, and we spoke about a few of them, come in these small, often unspoken pieces of seeing Josh reclaim his background and his heritage. We spoke about the "They're Your People Too" moment between him and this elder Māori woman. But one of my favorite parts was in the scene where he's filming the initial protest, and he sees these Māori people at the front, facing down this crowd of policemen, and he lowers the camera just to watch them. And you see in his face this incredible depth of emotion. Was that something that you, of course, bringing in your own experiences and wanting to combine them with Julian's own, did you spend a lot of time working out those, you know, small moments?
Yeah, I certainly feel that I'm totally on board with that idea of it's the moments between the moments that count. It's those little details, you know? And so absolutely, those moments where they all matter. When he lowers that camera, that's a deliberate decision. That for him, that this is a turning point in his life. It's a recognition of an awareness, a growing awareness of this is who he is, and this is who he could be. I guess a really lovely story with the young people who were performing that haka. They are of that region. They are mana whenua of that region. And I guess as much as they were performing there, that is who they are. The way they are as young men and women, in many ways they epitomized where Josh would like to be as a person, with a true deep understanding of who they are. Mm-hmm. There's a concept in Te Ao Māori called Turanga Waiwai, which is the idea of having your own standing place, of knowing where you stand. And ultimately, that's what Josh is searching for this entire film, this place to know where he stands. And those young people there, they know that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that gives a security and a strength moving forward. That's what Josh is searching for in this picture. And so it was a pretty beautiful moment to be there to see that happening. I think it was kind of that idea of the truth and the fiction and the non-fiction kind of combining beautifully.
I know you said that your first priority was to create an entertaining and an inspiring film without thinking too much about like sending a message, but I feel that there are so many young people out there who could see themselves in Josh. Yeah. And even behind that camera, the idea of a crowd of people seeing through Josh's eyes these confident young people knowing where they stand, as you said. How do you feel about this, I think, maybe gap that you're filling with this movie of creating an image of a confident, self-assured person that maybe young Maori people like Josh could see and have maybe an awakening within themselves, a desire to reconnect with that culture?
Yeah, there's a universal quality to the picture. I mean, Hamish has spoken beautifully, I think, about the unique insight into that for young Maori people. But I think that there is a universal quality to the feeling that you get from that sense of power, that sense of determination and self-will.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, I think, is a universal thing. I mean, the exciting part of the rest of the world seeing this picture is that there's an inclusive quality to it. You can come into this movie. It's very specific from a New Zealand perspective, but it's something for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's a quality I love. And I was saying this before, there's a kind of family of people who have made this picture, and it's the perspectives that have actually made it universal. It's made it something that hopefully anybody can see, because it has a wide audience, but feel affected by it. It's the emotions of the picture that you're getting. It's not really, it doesn't have to be so specific, but it's the emotion of the picture that's beautiful and universal. And so, yeah, so I think the message, like you're saying, is a great one, because, you know, he's 17 years old to make that, decision, to make a decision, if you know what I mean, is the key thing. Right now, in 2023, I think that's really important.
Yeah, I do think that idea that, like, as I said in an early interview, I think the more specific something is, the more universal it can become. And I think, there's always going to be parallels that can be shared between cultures. And as much as Josh's story is a very specific one and very unique to him and very unique to our country, I think people are going to find their connections to it regardless of your culture and your society. And I think, you know, the idea that for me, Josh, he's a misfit in more than one way. And I think people will be able to find their connection to that misfit quality in different ways. You're not going to be struggling to find a way to connect to him because you're not Marty, for instance.
Yes. You know? Yeah, totally. He's so lovely in that welcoming way. Because it's vulnerability too, which I think is really beautiful about Julian's performance. And it's like Tui, met a bell at the end speaking to Minnie, where she says, you know, we've all got our stories, we're yours with pride. And it's, we've all got our stories. It's kind of awesome, you know.
Yeah, it's a fantastic message. Mm. Well, we spent a while talking about the film, and I didn't want to cut us off because I'm so glad to hear from you about it. But I wanted to circle back a little bit to hear more about your creative partnership.
Mm-hmm.
Paul, you directed your first feature about 20 years before you did yours, Hamish. And I want to know a little bit about how you came together, about what you brought to this creative partnership for each other.
Well, I think the fact was, we knew that the two of us together would be making a more powerful film than the individual. And so I think from that point of view, I suppose all of the choices in terms of cast, in terms of location, in terms of all of the major decisions, excuse me, were something we certainly worked on together, very much so. And I think from Hamish's point of view, and he'll speak about this, what's very important, of course, from a writing and storytelling point of view, is something he's always that's going to be at the top of his priority from my perspective as well. That is one there too, but I also was wanting to utilize some of my experience to be able to get the machine, get the machine running from that perspective. But we very much, everything was we agreed on our choices throughout the whole film. And then really, it was very much down to the two of us being able to agree on something meant that from that perspective, we were getting, we were both hard taskmasters. Mm-hmm. So if it worked for both of us, it was a great thing.
Yeah. So, I mean, that process was, obviously me and Paul hadn't met before I started writing.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, we did come at it from two very, very different places, I guess. You know, Paul's come from an incredibly experienced commercials director world, and I've come from a teaching world, essentially. So we come with different perspectives, but I think ultimately what we're trying to do is make the same story.
Mm-hmm.
It's always going to be a challenge, and it's always going to have imperfections in there, but I think what we both had, what you've always got to hold on to, is the fact that you're trying to make the same story. And ultimately, I feel that we have.
Mm-hmm.
And so, although creative decision making, it created challenges, because you both have your visions. What we tried our hardest to do, and what I feel we achieved, mm-hmm. is create a shared vision which everyone can be, I guess, pleased with.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's we love the film that much that it's turned out the way, in terms of, do you know what I mean? Like, there's been, Hamish was, I was inspired by the picture, and Hamish is inspired. And so as we built that together, it meant so much to both of us that we knew whatever we were going to do, we were just going to try and make the film as good as it could be.
Mm.
For whatever reason, and that often just has to do with the simplest things, where you might have a particular, you might have something that musically you lean towards in one way or another.
Mm-hmm.
And so you don't even necessarily work out compromise. What you work out is, how can we include both of these things?
Mm-hmm.
How can we see how this can actually give it more richness? And so on like that. And for instance, like, the film has an amazing, a commercial track to it, in terms of all these different songs, some of which are close to me and some of which are very close to Hamish, do you know what I mean? And so you kind of feel like, in a way, it does have that, great big beautiful world quality to all the different feelings and tones and what was New Zealand, 1981, and Dunedin, was all of these things.
I wanted to ask about that, actually, because you have this... We may be running out of time,
yeah.
So this might have to be our last question.
Yeah.
But you have this soundtrack of selected tracks, but you also have an original score that pops in for some of the most important moments in the film. So how did you go about blending those two elements?
Well, the great thing was that Hamish has had a great experience with Carl in his last film. And he said, Carl's got to do this. So I trusted him. Carl's amazing.
So, yeah, Carl Stephen, who created score, he's an amazing composer. I think he cares deeply about films that he makes.
Mm-hmm.
And so every element of that story matters to him from a sound point of view. One thing that was really, really lovely is his incorporation of different elements, which, although they may not necessarily be overtly recognised, add to the depth of the story. Like, as an example, he used incorporated her name's Ariana Tikau. She's a Māori taonga puoro player, so she plays traditional Māori instruments. And so what he did is he worked alongside her to incorporate some of her sounds into the film, and they create first of all, she's Kaitahu, she's from that area.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a very important kind of a element for us. But the other thing is that, even the process that he went through with that is he didn't tell Ariana that he wanted this from her. She watched it and she played what she felt was right for it and then incorporated that way. So it was a really incredibly collaborative approach to creating score. And I think that's probably another thing that's really important to us, important to the film, is that as much as me and Paul were the directors, it was incredibly team focused and incredibly reliant on the skills of those people that were around us. Yeah,
it's amazing. Like Carl's, you know, a white Kiwi, you know, and she's, you know, Māori. Again, the way mixing those things together was wonderful.
Well, there's so much that I'd want to ask, but of course our time is limited here. Thank you so much for speaking with me today. I encourage everyone, I'm not sure if by the time this goes up there'll be any more screenings at TIFF, but as soon as the film comes out, I hope that everyone has a chance to see it. It really is such a communal experience. As you were saying, the feeling is really universal no matter what you're coming at it from. And yeah, it really warmed my heart to see it. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Welcome back to the present moment, October 6th, 2023. Wow, we were just listening to an interview done 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, 3 weeks. My concept of time is crazy. 3 weeks of Callum with Paul Middleditch and Hamish Bennett. Thank you so much to Callum for that fantastic interview. That was really interesting. I learned so much about that film and about the history of New Zealand. So now, as I promised at the beginning of the episode, we're going to hear the first red carpet interview that I'm playing on Schmodio. We've been releasing them on our Instagram account, but this one is the first to be on the radio. And the thing about the red carpet interviews, as I said earlier in the episode, is that they're a little different. They're a little more janky. They're a little more schmoey, but in a way that works well. And this one was only audio. So sometimes on the red carpet, we would record it on video as well. But I honestly find interviews that are just audio, you have the interviewer's full attention, because if they think a camera, any person, I don't know if any person is above this, if you think a camera is on you, a really small part of your brain is wondering how you look on that camera. You know, maybe you're adjusting, maybe you're not doing anything differently, but you're a small part of you is distracted wondering if you look attractive in this on camera. So when it's just audio with people that you're talking to, they're like, they can be entirely focused on you. So even though a lot of red carpet, you know, you want to see what the person is wearing, it's kind of the point of red carpet in some ways. If you want to get a good interview, I mean, we still got fantastic interviews with people who are being filmed, but I just think that that's an interesting concept of, like, if you're just thinking about the voice, which is just attached to the brain, then you might be able to get a slightly more relaxed version of a person. And that's not everyone, that's just some people. So I'm going to play this interview with Sam Levy. He was the cinematographer for his three daughters. So this was the first time that I ever interviewed a cinematographer. And when you're on the red carpet, because of the writer's strike, because like TIFF was weird this year for those reasons, we didn't really know who we were going to be talking to on the red carpet until we got there. And then a lot of the time, a lot of the people who you thought were going to be there weren't. And some people who they said weren't going to be there turned up. So you sort of had to like think of questions on the fly, which is really fun, but also slightly scary. And I'd never interviewed a cinematographer before, so I was sort of learning what to ask as I was asking it and seeing sort of like I remember asking a question, and as soon as it came out of my mouth being like, oh my God, a cinematographer is not going to care about this question. And then he was like, oh my God, this is such a good question. And I was like, oh my God, well, I clearly have, sometimes you just got to go against your instinct. So he was a cinematographer for his three daughters. I'm going to read the quick synopsis on the TIFF website. Later on, I'll also play the interview that I had with the director, probably next episode. So, His Three Daughters is a tense, captivating, and touching portrait of family dynamics starring Carrie Coon, Elizabeth Olsen, and Natasha Lyonne as sisters who converge after their father's health declines. So it's basically a film where these three daughters come back to take care of their dying father, and you don't see the father the whole film. It's really just about the sibling dynamics between these three sisters, which everyone can relate to if you have a sibling, right? It's sort of a universal thing. You come together with your sibling as your parent, you know, inevitably ages. So I was excited to sort of talk about those aspects of the film with the people that worked on it. So here is my red carpet interview with Sam Levy. Here we go.
I love your name. I know a lot of loveys. Oh, thank you. It was my grandmother's, actually. It's a chain with a brooch taped to it. Congratulations on the film. Congratulations on your denim jacket. I love it.
Thank you. I'll take it.
Yeah, you should. How does it feel to be watching this film for the first time that you poured a lot of heart and soul into?
It's a cliche, but it's a dream come true, especially after the last few years coming out of the pandemic, to be able to sit in the Princess of Wales Theater at TIFF in a, I'm told, almost 2,000 seat house with people watching something I got to work on is something I really, really don't take for granted. I like to think I never took it for granted. There's no guarantee that when you go to work on something that it will get out there in the world and that people will see it or that it'll show anywhere. But especially now, I'm really grateful to be here.
Me too. How, as the DP and the person that is, you know, filming everything, when this is an incredibly emotional film, what is your technique for capturing this like deep emotion? Do you have a different style for a film that is so intimate in mostly one location between three people that have an incredibly deep bond?
That's a great question. I think the technique I used for this film, which is a film that has a lot of dialogue between the three sisters and their dad, interweaving dialogue, was to in some ways treat the dialogue like it was music or even sound design, but it's very important what they're talking about at any one time. But the sound of them talking has to be resonant the way a great score would be. And so part of the starting point is, you know, you take the script, and Aza and I would go to my studio, which is not far from the location, and we would just go page by page and break the script down and break each line down and then talk about the shots we maybe thought would work with an eye towards just all of these dialogues interweaving and what's going to keep the viewer engaged, and kind of understanding the shared experiences of the three sisters. And that was the approach, you know, the intent. And it's for the audience to decide, I guess, if it worked out.
That's really interesting that you're thinking about the dialogue as if it's a score. And yeah. What do you mean by that? Why is it different from a film that has less dialogue? Why is the dialogue in this film more like music?
Because the dialogue is very prevalent in this movie. So if you take a movie like, just off the top of my head, take an older movie like Jerry by Gus Van Sant, you know, a movie that, or you know, a Bélatar movie, you know, Satan Tango by Bélatar, that something that has very few lines of dialogue, then the cinematography becomes something different. You're kind of telling the story more without words, and the images do a lot of the talking for you. Whereas in this movie, there are sequences like that, but overwhelmingly, you're observing the three sisters having these long and very ornate conversations over, you know, 10 or 11 pages sometimes. So how do you do that? And the way in is just very methodically to go through each page and say, like, okay, this first page, we want to kind of ease our way into the conversation. And then by the end, where they're, you know, having an argument and it's very heated, you really need to be sitting forward on your chair. So how do you do that? It's just a piece by piece, step by step kind of thing.
Do you mean the audience needs to be sitting forward in their chair?
Yeah, exactly. You know, we don't want the audience to tune out. And so when you're when the task before you is 11 pages of dialogue in a conversation, where maybe they might drift for 5 seconds and come back in, then this idea that it's like sound or music takes hold. The way, you know, if you were to go see, you know, an orchestra perform, or even, you know, listen to a pop song, you're not necessarily like glued to the song at all times, but you might still have a really intense emotional reaction.
Okay, I'm starting to understand now. So in a film that has less dialogue, the job of the cinematographer is to tell the story, to tell it, or to show it rather, to show the story through what's happening. And when there is much more dialogue, when the film is much more dialogue heavy, that job is shifts a little bit because the dialogue is telling the story more than the filming is. Is that correct? So
yeah, from my experience, and cinematography and filmmaking it's such a personal pursuit, and it's like everyone has their handwriting. You know, it's each person does things differently, and for this project, and you know, for where I am in my life, and you know, creative career at this moment, that was sort of how we did this one.
Okay, this is my last question because you're quite tall and I'm quite short and my arm is getting tired. No, don't worry. But how does one become a cinematographer? How does one know that that's what you want to do when you're a kid? You watch movies and you can't see the cinematographer, but you can see the actor saying, oh, I'd love to be an actor, I'd love to be a writer. How do you stumble upon, oh, I want to film it, I want to be a part of it behind the camera?
I think it's different for each person. I can only speak to my own experience. When I was in college, I took a film class. I was a literature student in college. I never was like a real film student, but I took a film class, and I was lucky. I sort of quickly realized the camera was the thing I was good at, and you know, I was maybe a little interested, could I direct or could I write, but it just kept sort of presenting itself. It was something that I, to be frank, I realized I'd have an easier road photographing a movie than anything else. But how do you discover it? Just, you know, I grew up loving movies and I just love them. I never thought about doing it as a job. And then being very lucky, my teacher of that class looked at some of the stuff I was doing and said, you know, you could probably do this if you wanted.
It's always a teacher.
And I think, or just, you know, mentorship in general. I would say, you know, if people listen to this or read this, or you don't have to go to film school. That's not necessarily the answer. It's a great way to do it. I'm not besmirching going to film school, but if you can't afford it or it's just not in the cards, that doesn't necessarily need to happen. Really, the answer is you just go out and make stuff, and through whatever means, you know, your phone or, you know, a handy cam, or if you can get your hands on film, all of those things work, and you just have to have the will, maybe the work ethic, to just go out and start making things, and you just go shoot things, and you just keep any opportunity to shoot. And if you're not sure if it's for you, just go shoot some stuff. And if you like it and it's fun and you could envision maybe doing this, you know, devoting your life to it, then just keep doing it. And then eventually someone will ask you to come shoot something for them, and maybe they'll even pay you something. And if not, just keep doing it anyways. And, you know, you can find a job, you know, at a coffee shop or through whatever means. It's just really about the will. When it comes down to it, it's all about your will to go do it.
Thank you so much. Thank you for your time.
Thanks,
congratulations on the film. Thanks so much.
All right. Bye. Take care.
Wow, Sam Levy. How interesting is Mr. Sam Levy? I have to say that interview was like